interview the speaker for today, for this afternoon, Christine B.
Hey everybody, I am Christine B.
Hey, Christine.
And first I want to thank the committee. Thank you for your service. I want to thank and congratulate everybody in the room for your commitment to your recovery. Because it's in rooms like this that I have gotten some very powerful lessons. I remember I was in the program, I got into the program in Jackson, Mississippi in May 1985. And the first week they had a conference and I went to a conference and this Indian guy got up and he said, "This is the program of love." And I'm thinking, okay, I'm out of here. I'm out of here. So my story's a little different from a lot of Al-Anons. I didn't come here to get anybody sober. I was completely and totally isolated and alone, except for one member, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He did not live in my town. He had been my counselor, and he was my line to sanity. I came to you because every day I was standing in front of the mirror and saying, I have it in me to hold it together today. And what I wanted from you, because you were going to give me back the ability to hold it together. And my life has been filled with miracles ever since. Have you ever had one of those insignificant, ordinary, everyday moments that changed your whole perspective? So in February, I heard the doorbell and I went and there was a box sitting outside. I hadn't ordered anything. And it was a pretty big box, so I pulled the box inside, and I went and got my little box cutter knife, and I opened it up. And what was inside, one more time, the gift, the miracle, the gift of love, changed my whole perspective of my life. Now, I was in the program for about 4 weeks in Jackson, Mississippi. And I lost my job. And so it was time for a geographical cure. I was done with Mississippi. So I did not grow up there. Mississippi was a geographical cure, but we'll get to that later. So I had two choices. I could move to Washington, D.C., where I had good connections through my employment, where I could get a job. Or I could move here to Atlanta, Georgia, where I had one friend, that sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I moved to Jackson, Mississippi, I had just left one of my qualifiers, and I moved for a job. I knew nobody in Jackson, Mississippi, and I was there for 5 years. And so I decided to move to Atlanta, where I knew one person. So I called and asked him if I could come stay with him till I found a job. And he said, of course, which amazed me. So I got in my little car, and I drove down in a week. I had an assignment with a temporary agency. I had an apartment. I went back to Jackson, Mississippi, hired some day laborers, loaded up my truck, attached my car to a trailer, and here I came. Now, during that week, I had found two Al-Anon meetings. So I got here on a Friday afternoon. Even though I had asked for help, I didn't know that, you know, help unloading all of the trucks. So the truck was empty when my friend got there the next day, except for the heavy furniture that I couldn't move by myself. But I went to the Al-Anon meeting after I'd unloaded my truck. After I'd been here about a week, I was walking around the pond. It was in my apartment complex. And this real good-looking little guy said hello. And I just fell in love immediately with his voice. And it turned out he was a classical musician. He was a piano player. And he had a job at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel downtown. And I happened to be working in a law firm that was kind of across the street. And I knew he had a piano in his house, but he didn't play. He was a professional. He wasn't playing to impress me. So I decided that if I was going to hear him play, I needed to go to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel for lunch. So I chose the day that I knew he was at work. I had on my best clothes. Fortunately, I had a short conversation with the receptionist there. And she said, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do what you just did, move to a strange place all by yourself. And I smiled and I said, thank you. And I'm thinking, what courage? It just takes a little insanity, that's all. But when I got to the doors of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, I could not go in. Because I knew that the moment I walked in those doors, they would know that I didn't belong there. I came from the wrong side of the tracks. I came from the streets. They would know that I didn't, and they would escort me right back out those revolving doors. And then I heard that lady's voice saying, it took courage for you to move here. And I went, okay, if I can do that, I can walk through those doors. So I took a deep breath. I didn't know to look up and ask God for help then. And the maitre d' welcomed me in, led me to my seat, shook out my napkin, put it in my lap, and treated me like an honored guest. I was stunned. And remember, I only had about 6 weeks in the program. So when I got here, you know, they said, get a sponsor. I even heard that in Jackson. I decided I needed two. So I let go of two in Jackson, and I moved here. So I thought, I'll do the same thing. I was going to two meetings, so I got one from each meeting. And I thought that, you know, the program, I was going to learn how to avoid dangerous people. And I wasn't going to have any more alcoholics in my life. Forget that one of my sponsors was a double winner. Just, yeah. Now, when I first got here, it's been reported to me, and I noticed the behavior. When I would walk into the room, people would kind of stand around and wait till I sat down, and then they would sit down. They didn't want to sit next to me. Because they knew I was angry, but I didn't. And I was going to a facilitated adult children's meeting. And in that meeting, this lady said that she had experienced incest in her family and that she had forgiven the members. And I wanted to choke her. I thought, she's a liar. I was furious. Because see, when I got to you, that's when I started knowing why I was angry. hello, little fly. How are you? So one of the first secrets I want to tell you about was, one of the secrets was, my grandfather was a pedophile, and I was one of his girls. Now, in therapy, one day we were talking about, you know, my parents didn't get up in the morning and say, I'm going to make Christine's life miserable. And when I first did that first four step, you know, the message was, well, you couldn't help anything. Well, after a few years, I realized that left me a victim. And then I remembered, you know, this program has taught me there has to be an action. And I didn't have an action. And when I had the action, I was the child that was there. Oh, now I have something I can do. I no longer clean up and show up to be abused. And when people are being abused, and I found out abuse is many degrees. I can hang up the phone. I can leave. I can say, this is not acceptable. You will not treat me this way. The other memory, you know, and denial can be very strong. One day I'm getting ready to go someplace and I'm looking in the mirror and I finally see the cigarette burns, scars that are on my chest and arms. I'd never seen them before. And I can't say exactly that it was my mother, but that was who I was furious with. So, my father liked to be married. I'm going to go into relationships here a little bit. My father liked to be married. He just didn't stay married very long. When he passed away, his score was 6. He was widowed 3 times. He was divorced 3 times. And my brother and I had bets on the outcome of number 7 if he made it. But in the late 50s, when he divorced my mother, the state of Louisiana gave him custody of me and my baby brother, Bruce. And I got to stay with my mother for a little while, but she was not to leave the state of Louisiana with me, which of course she did. And then one day this man showed up and she said, this is your dad. And he brought me to Memphis. There was this lady sitting on the porch and he said, this is your new mom. I said, okay. And a few weeks later, we went back to that little town of Mississippi. And I remember, you know, we were in a courtroom or some big room. And my mother, the state of Mississippi, affirmed that custody. And my mother was crying and she said, you won't keep her. I'm coming to get her. And she did, right before I found you in my early 30s. So, my father's second marriage, you know, things were pretty normal. The way I see normal. There were birthday parties, you know, I got to play with kids. But she was ill, she had an enlarged heart, and she died at home. So, then Daddy's third marriage, the disease of alcoholism meets insanity. That's when the violence started. My father is a violent schizophrenic. His disease progressed. And I'm just going to share a couple of stories from life at home. One of the first stories, and this was important to my way of thinking, my stepmother, she liked to take trips. And she came in, and I was running the vacuum cleaner, and I guess she didn't like the way I was doing it, which was pretty normal. And she was beating me with the vacuum cleaner because I had told her that I hated her, and I realized that day she could beat me, but she could not change my mind. And because of her violence, Daddy quit calling her off for a little while. And one day I saw her in the bathroom, and she was, you know how kids, we dance when we get that spanking? Well, she tripped my brother, and she was kicking him up against an iron tub. And I decided she would never trip me. So from that moment on, if I could, I took all my beatings to my back, because I could walk away, and I didn't feel them. Well, and we were all violent. You know, I passed on to my baby brother and sister what was passed on to me. So the thing that broke the family up, there was a knife fight in our front yard. We were a violent neighborhood, you know. Sometimes the streets were safer than what was going on in the house, and sometimes the house was safer than what was going out on the streets. You just had to choose. So there was a knife fight with a neighbor, and my father was home on leave from one of his hospital stays. And the interesting thing to me was I got the kids across the street, and to me it looked like a two-dimensional cartoon. And it was funny. And I made a decision that I knew that I was capable of that kind of violence, so I was never going to be angry again. I was about 16 years old, and I was already having rage blackouts. But I'm never going to get angry again. And the miracle is I nearly succeeded. So that's the kind of insanity that you greeted in May of 1985. So then I decide it's time to work the steps, and I need a new sponsor because I had to fire one of those sponsors, and the one that was left was a little afraid of me. And I would call her, and she would say, "Have you talked to your counselor yet?" And I was like, so it's like, okay. Yeah, because when I got here, I had two gods. I had the God that was wonderful, that had nature and animals and sun, and I could go out into the woods or a park and find a little bit of peace. And then there was the God that I had been given in the church that was the punishing, awful God. Because I had decided that if what was going on at my house was an indication of how God felt about me, I didn't have. What hope did I have? But you gave me permission for the God of nature. So the trust of bringing that personal had started. So I said a prayer about finding a new sponsor, and I went to a meeting, and there she was, and I was like, oh no, not her. I had seen her do a group inventory. That's when I met of my favorite little group, and I just wanted to know who in the hell she thought she was to ask us those kinds of questions. So she said yes, and she wasn't afraid of my anger. And she led me through the steps. Now, the other thing that happened really the first week that was important to my recovery, the first week I was here, I came to my office, and the book, The Road Less Traveled, was on my desk. And from that book, I got three things. One was a fallacy. I was going to be through in 6 months. The other is I knew I was going to have to hurt. coach. It's like, okay, for 6 months I can do that. That's doable. And the third thing was that love was work. And that was exciting because I didn't know anything about love, but I knew how to work. So what's the work of love? Well, the work of love is service. And you guys knew I needed service, so you put me to work right away. I mean, in less than 6 months, I was already at area service. And I was having some difficulties, and my wife's sponsor took me straight to the concept. I haven't finished the steps yet, but I have the concepts of service, and to me, they are weapons for winning wars against these crazy people. I'm perfectly fine. Well, it came time to change sponsors. And once again, God is wonderful. I chose somebody that was in service. And after a little while, you know, one day she called me and she said, I'm letting go of everybody that I've been working with a year or less. And I fell into that group. So it's like, okay, God. So I went back to my first sponsor. I said, can I come home for an interim? And she said, good. So if you change sponsors, don't burn the bridge. Do it with love. Do it with gratitude. Do it with love and do it with gratitude. So one night I was at one of our gatherings and there was this little old lady sitting there. And she just seemed to have a glow. And I knew. So I went and asked her. And she was very dedicated to service. She was one of the founding members of Georgia area, then Georgia State. And I just loved Dot. And Dot was taking care of a sick husband and a sick mother. So I didn't get to spend a lot of time with her. And when I would call her, she would give me a history lesson. And I would be thinking, what has that got to do with anything that I just called her about? And I would have to sit down and go through the concepts and the traditions and the steps. I would have to go through the literature. And I'd go, oh, that's what she was talking about. And my solution was there. So from there, I started when I had a problem. I would go through the concepts and I would go through the traditions and the steps and say, these are the principles that I think apply. And she would give me a history lesson. And then one day she said, I trust your recovery. Oh my God. Somebody trusted me. This woman who I entrusted implicitly trusted me. What a miracle. What a miracle. And I'm grateful for that. Because about 12 years into the program, you know, somebody calls it the second surrender. I don't know why they call it the second surrender. I've had hundreds of surrenders before I got there. But, you know, it just didn't seem to be working anymore. There were a lot of things going on. So the only thing quite to do is, you know, blow up the fellowship that I had. And that's what I did. But I went and told them that I was going to. I didn't just drop out. I told them. But Dot said, if you do this, you have to do the work. Because when you go into a meeting, if these people are in the room, you have to feel comfortable in your step and you have to be able to go up and hug them and say, I love you because of all the contributions they have made to your life. Boy, I was angry about that, but you know what? I did the work and I got there before I told them. And then, you know, I got to keep the gifts, and I kept hearing human involvement. So, now I didn't get out of the program. I was doing service. I was married. I was living in another part of town. I was going through the service manuals with a group of women. And I started doing community service, and I found Rotary International, service above self. It's a different kind of service. But to me, service is what we do to improve or give people the opportunity to improve their lives and ours. So now I'm going to talk about some of those relationships. When I got here, I had not spoken to my father decade and a half. And, you know, started getting the messages, it's time to call. So I started making those phone calls, and Dot gave me rules. And the rules were, I could only talk about the dog, his dog, the weather, and it had to be okay that no matter what my state was when I hung up the phone, I was okay. Because sometimes I was hurt, sometimes I was angry, and sometimes it was a fun conversation. My father, being a, you know, violent schizophrenic, can give you some very interesting viewpoints on life. And I finally got to the point where I could invite him into my home. And he did come visit. The last time I saw him alive, he had spent Christmas with me for a week. And our last words, he got sick. And he was in the hospital. I talked to him on a Thursday. And I said, Daddy, I will be there Saturday. He said, okay. He was in Memphis. And Saturday morning, I got the call and he had passed. But our last words were, I love you, and we meant it. So that was 1999, and okay, I've taken care of Daddy. I guess it's time to talk to Mama. Because, you know, when I met Mama, I thought I was going to have that emotional net. It didn't happen. But, and this was before recovery, I remember going to her and say, this is just not working for me. It wasn't working for my brother. It wasn't working for me. So I said, I'll get back to you. So I got back to her. And I was in a Dale Carnegie sales class where I was a coach. I did service in a whole lot of places. And my commitment to my goal for in front of the class was I was going to build a relationship with my mother. And the instructor looked at me and he said, what will be your evidence? And the only evidence I could think of was her number will be on my telephone bill every week. That was 2000. And her phone number has been on my telephone bill every week. My mother is not an easy person to talk to. I thought that I got all my character defects from my father. After all, I grew up with him, right? He was the one that was there. Well, my husband and I spent a weekend with her, and on the way home, I made amends for so many attitudes. My mother's a mean woman. Today she's in a nursing home, and she feels good by the miracles of drugs. I think they finally found the right one. Now, I had a couple of siblings with this, and, you know, I pretty much raised my younger siblings. And I have a brother, his name's Bruce. And one day, I got a telephone call at 5 o'clock in the morning. He said, "Hi, Christine, this is Bruce." And I said, "My name's Christine, but I don't know a Bruce." He said, "This is Bruce." I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know a Bruce." He says, "This is your brother, dumbass." And I went, "Oh, oh, that Bruce." So today, he still lives in Memphis. And, you know, God has a lot of angels. God loves us in so many ways. After my husband and I got married, Bruce called me, and he had met this young lady, and he got married, and I was so surprised, because of all of us, Bruce was the most dangerous. And she has an adult child that has a 6-year-old mentality who is deaf. The angel that saved my brother's life. To see my brother take care and pay attention, loving attention to that young man. Such a miracle. Such a miracle. The only way that these miracles happen is a loving relationship with the God of my growing understanding. Today, my God is life itself. When I had been here 6 years, I was doing a service project for a friend. I met a young man, fresh back from Desert Storm. I was never going to get married. I was dedicated single person. We met July the 4th, 1991. He proposed August the 8th, 1991. And we were married October the 24th, 1991. My husband is in neither program. But the first, he's a student of the Course in Miracles. And the first year that we were married, he went to Al-Anon for a year. He worked the steps with a sponsor, and I did the lessons in the back with him. We created a spiritual foundation for our marriage. And today, you know, you told me it was going to be a lot of work, and it has been. You know, I met a man in the rooms, and he said, "Honey, you never get it worked out. You just keep working it out." And we're still working it out. But nobody told me how much fun. We pray together, and we laugh together. My husband travels a lot. For you young ladies looking for a husband so you don't have to be alone. There was a couple of years with his job, we did garment bag exchanges at the airport. He still travels a great deal. Matter of fact, a few weeks ago, he was in Japan. And he ended up in the hospital in Japan. And you know, when I found out the wheels are going, I'm making plans, because where he was in Japan, because of the time differences, it takes almost 2.5 days to get there. And I have a lot to do to get ready to spend time in Japan. And on one of the phone calls, he said, "The doctor says this is serious, but we're going to do a slow healing." And at that moment, a light enveloped me, and I knew I didn't have to go. My job was here. And in Japan, when you're in ICU, they let people come see you. He had co-workers visiting him every day. He had trouble with phone connection, and somebody from work showed up with a little gadget, Wi-Fi gadget. He didn't have slippers. Somebody showed up with slippers. He didn't have pajamas, so the lady who owns the hotel where he's always stayed came and gave him pajamas. God was taking care of him. I didn't need to be there. I need to be right here, at home so you guys could love me through it. So, yes, absolutely, this is the age of miracles. And I'm one of them. Thank you for your kind attention. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot. Remember that box?
Yes.
So, I open up the box. And first thing I pulled out was a handmade quilt that my grandmother's sister made me before I was born. I didn't know she existed. There was a christening gown that my mother made for me. She hand-sewed it when she was pregnant with me. It was a christening gown for my brother and my sister. There was a little white coat that my grandmother made for, little lace collar, perfect condition. And there were some little booties that an uncle who made I'd never heard of. I didn't know I was a beloved little girl. That has changed everything on how I see you and how I see myself. Because I'm less afraid of you. Because after all these years, that fear can still come up. So thank you for your kind attention. I love you, and thank you for your part in my recovery.